So this is just kind of a follow-up to some of our discussion that we've had for the last few meetings on Asian Buddhism and how Buddhism is changing as it meets the West, and kind of all the contributions that are unique in Western Buddhism, and some of the good parts about that, helpful parts, and maybe in my mind some of the not so helpful parts. And so one of the big differences that we've talked about is how Western Buddhism is primarily lay Buddhism. And that's one big difference. Another big difference is that it's come over more as a spirituality and less as a religion, so more as a practice, and practice only. I certainly emphasize Dharma and the teachings of the Buddha, but I don't emphasize the religious aspects and cultural aspects that you would get in Asia. And most Western Dharma teachers in the Theravada tradition also don't really bring over any of the religious aspects. So it's lay Buddhism primarily, and that's great. And it's also, in some ways, a big loss too. One of the differences, one of hopefully the pros in Buddhism going more lay, is that there tends to be a lot more emphasis on engaged Buddhism, on Buddhism that's really grappling with all the social and political issues. Monastic Buddhism, though there's certainly examples of it, it's not to say it's never been engaged Buddhism, but I can speak from the Theravada tradition, and for anyone who doesn't know, that's the part of Buddhism that comes from Southeast Asia, Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Laos. And it's the flavor of it compared to Zen or Tibetan Buddhism is more renunciant, an emphasis more on non-harming. There's not so much the Mahayana or Bodhisattva emphasis, though that's clearly a part of any human being, is this wish to benefit others. So I'm really speaking about the Theravada tradition because that's what I know more about. And I'm not any kind of expert on this, so just take everything with a little grain of salt, maybe just as something to have as maybe not a conclusion, but as a hypothesis. There's actually quite, there's a lot of examples of Theravada monastics being involved politically. Just though, in terms of the flavor, if you're in a really, if you're in a Theravada monastery that's really dedicated to kind of following the Vinaya, which are the set of rules that the Buddha laid down for monks and nuns, and where it's really genuine spiritual practice, like the monastery I was in Thailand for 3 months, there's really an emphasis on not getting political. Essentially, the monastic path is one about completely devoting your life to liberation. And from this one perspective, really talking about politics a lot can rile the mind and not be good for your meditation. That was kind of like the skinny I got in the monastery. So that's kind of, like when you really get into the nitty-gritty of Theravada monasticism, that's kind of the flavor. You're just going to stir up your mind. Don't go there. So it's not to say that Theravada monastics are never political, and there's lots of examples. Ajahn Jomian is a Thai monk, very, very cool, incredibly strong meditation practice. And he's brokered ceasefires in civil wars in his region of Thailand. Mahagosananda is a very, very well-known monk from Cambodia who pretty much did all of his work in the refugee camps in the killing fields when all that was going on in the 70s, 80s in Cambodia. Recently in Burma, all the protests, I think it was 2 years ago, where monks and nuns would walk through Yangon with their alms bowls turned upside down as a protest, like, we are not going to accept food. And in Theravada countries, this is a huge act because it means they're not going to eat that day or the next day or the next day. They're basically on a hunger strike. And it's really a way of saying this is really serious, the oppression that's happening in Burma and the military dictatorship. And they were really cracked down on. So this is not to say political action never happens. It's just not nearly as strong in Theravada monasticism as it is in our lay world. So this is maybe one of the real benefits of Buddhism being very lay-oriented, is we don't have that prohibition. So as Western values and more a sense of Western engagement meet Asian, primarily monastic Buddhism, there's a sense of different values coming in, egalitarian values. In the monastery I was in, it was hierarchical. And thinking of different stories about, the basic idea was that hierarchy is actually a way of subverting ego. That if we're always having to invent traditions and do it for ourselves, it can be very ego-oriented. It can actually be very let go to just make way for a senior monk. That's just the way it's set up. The Buddha set it up that way. The monasticism started in Asia 2,500 years ago when the caste system was very strong. It's still in India today. So back then it was very radical for the Buddha to set up a monastic community where there was no recognition of caste. Extremely radical. So the way hierarchy was set up was just simply around seniority. How long have you been in robes? So everything's set up that way. That's really different than in our world. As these more egalitarian values and our democratic values meet Buddhism, we're changing Buddhism. And so I'm going to talk tonight about how Buddhism coming in contact with the West actually brings into contrast some of the shadow side, what we in the West would consider the shadow side of Buddhism. Buddhist sexism, Buddhist nationalism, even Buddhist militarism, both historical as well as contemporary, happening right now. We think of, because of how we have inherited the Buddhist tradition as primarily being a path of realization. We don't know all of these cultural underpinnings in Buddhist practice. We definitely have them because we're bringing our culture to it. But the historical tradition of Buddhism, it has many examples of it just being like any other religion. Dogma, violence even in the name of religion, and it just sounds to us completely oxymoronic. We think of the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh or Aung San Suu Kyi when we think of Buddhism. And yet, the reason we don't know all that is because for us it's primarily a spiritual path. It's a practice path. And so we're just not engaged with Buddhism in any kind of religious or cultural way. But it's there. To us, it can seem completely oxymoronic that you could have Buddhist militarism, Buddhist violence, Buddhist sexism. The path of meditation and the liberating path of meditation cuts our attachment. It cuts our sense of separate self, and it especially undercuts attachment to views, where in a way all violence comes from. If we're really strongly attached to a viewpoint, then bigotry, violence, etc., emanates from that. If you see a person being really violent, you're seeing someone very attached to their viewpoint. And our practice is supposed to undercut all that. So there's this irony or paradox within the tradition that a tradition that's devoted to practice and realization, and it works, and people do awaken through this practice, there's a lineage of it for 2,500 years, has a shadow side of all of this stuff. So I just want to address that, and I want to point us towards it, and let's talk about it. Like, you know, what does all this stir up in us, and what are the implications of it? So I'm going to start by talking about militarism in Japan in the time of World War II. And there's a book that came out, caused a lot of controversy 15 years ago, called Zen at War. And it was a historical account of how much not just Buddhist practitioners, but the Buddhist masters and teachers in Japan completely supported Japanese militarism, and in fact didn't see a real difference between furthering Buddhism and furthering Japanese nation states. And this already, you're probably like, you got to be kidding me. So I'll provide some historical context too, where that actually could make more sense to us. The way we understand Buddhism is more like this. There's a story that I've heard Stephen Smith tell of a Vipassana teacher, knowing this old, eccentric, like wonderful old Zen master, Paul Rebs, who's in Hawaii, and he's the only Westerner that ever got admitted to Japan during World War II. And on his application, so he's a Zen, you know, very deep Zen practitioner. On his application to gain a visa into Japan in whatever year that was, during World War II, he wrote, "Making a cup of tea, I stopped the war." Very Zen. This is the way we understand Buddhist practice, right? That we... how we act and how we are can either be peaceful or not peaceful. And we can quarrel with reality or we can align with reality. Making a cup of tea, I stopped the war. That had enough Zen potency, I guess, that he was accepted into Japan. I guess he wanted to study Zen. I'm not sure why he went. So the Japan he went to was very different. Now, I'm going to talk a lot about the examples of Zen teachers being aligned with the war effort. But there were also teachers who were either neutral or who actually protested against war. But that took tremendous amount of courage given the cultural context of Japan. So this is what Brian Victoria writes in another book, in the preface, about his previous book, Zen at War. And by the way, Brian Victoria himself is a Zen teacher. So this is not someone outside the tradition looking in and critiquing. This is someone in the tradition saying, this is our shadow side. We have to be aware of it. It's the only way to do shadow work is to bring it first to awareness. So in his mind, this is a bodhisattva act to actually, for us Westerners, not to just be naive and ideal about our Buddhist tradition. So he writes that his book, Zen at War, demonstrated that wartime Japanese masters, almost to a man, had been fervent supporters of Japanese militarism. Moreover, these masters claimed the Buddha Dharma was itself synonymous with that militarism, cloaking their support in the guise of such phrases as the unity of Zen and the sword. So, and then for this talk, I didn't actually have this book. I couldn't get it in time. But I've looked at some of his other articles online that relate to his book. And so I'm going to talk about his handling of some of the statements of Yasutani Roshi, who is one of the prime... let's say, root teachers of the Zen tradition in the U.S. So his students, Philip Kaplow, if you've heard of him, Robert Aiken Roshi, Maizumi Roshi, and also Brian Victoria, are some of the early Zen teachers in the U.S. And this teacher, Yasutani Roshi, is their teacher. And his writings, early writings in his life, were very nationalistic, very militant, anti-Semitic, things that you would just find shocking. I'll read some of them. Has anyone heard of Bernie Glassman, who does peacemaker order and does a lot of engaged Buddhist work? He's also one of the Dharma heirs of Yasutani. So what I'm going to read you will be shocking to hear it coming out of the mouth of a strong Buddhist practitioner. These are words that he wrote before he was actually a teacher, but he got Dharma transmission not long after he wrote this. So he's writing about this kind of Zen spirit that's allied with the war effort in Japan in 1943. What should the attitude of disciples of the Buddhas as Mahayana bodhisattvas be toward the first precept that forbids the taking of life? Right? Rule number one as a Buddhist. Do everything possible not to kill, not to harm other life. For example, what should be done in the case in which, in order to remove various evil influences and benefit society, it becomes necessary to deprive birds, insects, fish, etc. of their lives, or on a larger scale to sentence extremely evil and brutal persons to death, or for the nation to engage in total war. Those who understand the spirit of the Mahayana precepts should be able to answer this question immediately. That is to say, of course one should kill, killing as many as possible. One should, fighting hard, kill everyone in the enemy army. The reason for this is that in order to carry Buddhist compassion and filial obedience through to perfection, it is necessary to assist good and punish evil. However, in killing the enemy, one should swallow one's tears, bearing in mind the truth of killing, yet not killing. Don't ask me what that means. How's that hit you? It's hard to believe, right? In other writings, and to me it's almost just too painful to read, so I'm just not even going to read it, but the writings are so anti-Semitic. It sounds like someone out of Nazi Germany. Well, this is the time. And this is a Zen soon-to-be master. So when I read this article out of Tricycle Magazine, there's a lot of response from other teachers within the tradition, many of whom are Jewish, who basically said, this is a man before he's really received teaching transmission, probably before he really had deep awakening experiences. He's still a very strong practitioner, obviously, if he's, you know, almost got his Dharma transmission. But anyway, these students, he lived into the early 70s, and students like Philip Kaplow or Bernie Glassman just say they didn't see any of this. They didn't see his anti-Semitism, any of this. He changed. He changed a lot. But Brian Victoria would say those views would be representative of wartime Japan in the Buddhist clergy, the teachers. So this is not some kind of isolated example. And just to read something else from Yasutani much later, when he's really not writing and speaking this way at all, he says, "These days, many voices proclaim the sanctity of human life. Human life should, of course, be valued highly, but at the same time, the lives of other living beings should also be treasured. Human beings snatch away the lives of other creatures whenever it suits them. The way of thinking that encourages the behavior arises from a specifically human brand of violence that defies the self-evident laws of the universe, opposes the growth of the myriad things in nature, and destroys our feelings of compassion and reverence." That's sounding a lot more like it, right? If he wasn't maybe realized yet, but still a very strong practitioner, but his writings in World War II are representative maybe of the Buddhist teaching community, Zen masters, how is that possible? How is it possible to have degrees of realization and still be incredibly culture-bound and caught by cultural conditioning? So that's kind of our inquiry. And it will have bearing on us because we too are caught in our own conditioning. So one of Yasutani's students, who's a Dharma teacher, who's now Philip Kaplow, started the Rochester Zen Center, and his Dharma heir is Bodin Kholeti. I'm sorry, I'm sure I'm botching the pronunciation. Kholeti, I think. So he wants to really put this in context of the cultural conditioning that was in Japan. It's wartime. But going even back before wartime, he says, "A reading of Japanese history in the several decades following the Meiji Restoration in the late 1800s, reveals a populace subjected to nearly total thought control and indoctrination. Internal security laws against intellectual freedom were severely enforced, and the resulting information vacuum was filled with official militarism, which was grounded in the state-dominated public educational system. This standardized educational system inculcated total submissiveness to the militaristic authority and an awed obedience to the emperor. Every single subject in the national curriculum was oriented to war and patriotism. Yasutani Roshi was formed by this educational system and became a product of it, even more so than his contemporaries, for he was a school teacher and then a principal until he turned 40 and changed his career to a Zen priest." So he goes on to say, "The notion of religion and state as one had gathered steam in China during the Song Dynasty and later was absorbed into Japanese Zen, ready to assume its most patriotic and militaristic form in the nationalistic milieu of Yasutani Roshi's time. By then, the destruction of the Japanese nation was seen even by Zen masters as tantamount to the destruction of the Buddha realm, so much so that the Japanese military chose December 8th, which is December 7th in Hawaii, the Buddha's Enlightenment Day, to bomb Pearl Harbor." I didn't know that. Um, So it should be clear that awakening does not necessarily uproot cultural conditioning. And we have to get it that we cannot get away from cultural conditioning. We cannot. The analogy I used last week from the Taoist, Western Taoist philosopher Wei Wu Wei is the trouble with religion is everyone is arguing about the teapots instead of drinking the tea. Drinking the tea is our spiritual practice, is our personal experience of freedom. And through our practice, the teapot is the cultural container it comes in. We cannot do without teapots. There's no way to not do culture. We do culture. So this is, it's not like we won't have cultural conditioning. It's that we have to become aware of it, and we have to be really willing to look at our shadow side. And obviously, wartime is the most extreme situation, you know. The key is to know when we're simply in a personal or family or cultural bias or gender bias or you know, race bias or sexual orientation bias. It's to know when we're in it and to know when our views are coming not so much out of biases, but actually out of really clear seeing of how things are. So there's more to come. I'll stop here just to open it up, and then we'll take a break. So please feel free to contribute. Questions, comments... specifically how he would talk about maybe like what happened in World War II Japan or more generally.
I think more generally.
I'm not sure what the Dalai Lama would say exactly. My guess would be he would say something along the lines is delusion is endless. You know, that it is so easy to fool ourselves. And the only way to not fool ourselves, I'm just picturing the Dalai Lama, is to remember our deep altruistic wish, our bodhicitta. You know, that what really matters in life is to be of benefit, and that we're most happy when we're being of benefit. And everything else is delusion and confusion. I'm just making it up, but... I will address that from actually Bernie Glassman in his response to some of this dialogue talks about the nature of awakening and how delusion is still possible within awakening. That's kind of a Zen perspective. I'll share that a little more deeply.
It seems like an awakened state is not necessarily binary, you know, like something that either you know, state that you're either in or not in, but it could fluctuate over time.
Well, what's clearly recognized is there are stages of awakening where we have illuminations, we have realizations, and there's still a lot more work to do. And then is there a final enlightenment where there's no more work to do? You could probably ask, you know, 20 different, you know, very advanced Buddhist practitioners and get 20 different answers. In my world, when I was in the monastery in Thailand, they would talk about this monk or that monk as he finished with his practice. He was done. There's a final enlightenment. And that's really the Theravada view of awakening. There's many different views on this. So
I'm kind of implying like one potential interpretation of that to me is that like you were talking earlier about views or viewpoints basically that you're not aware that you're operating through, you know, as being one form of the influence.
Exactly.
one interpretation of that, like a final awakening, then would basically mean that there are no more beliefs, basically, that you're not aware that you're operating through. It basically implies to me, like, primordial consciousness. There's no viewpoint that you're ignorantly operating through.
Exactly. That would also be a Tibetan viewpoint. As I discussed, you know, as we talked about last week, and again, I'm speaking from the Tibetan tradition, I know that enlightenment is really never leaving the state of pure awareness, non-dual, effortless, pure awareness, never leaving the state. Views still arise, but one is never fooled by them if you're just never leaving pure awareness. You're always aware. And then action comes out of compassion as opposed to delusion or being blinded by a particular view. We still have views, though. What's cut is the attachment to them, or as you say, not knowing we're operating from them.
The transparency of the where you're just in a state where it's a transparent belief that you're not aware of it as such to you. It's just the way things are, something that you're so cognitively committed to. It's just a filter. It's filtering your perception of everything until you see it as such.
Yes. And I'm sorry, did you?
Well, I was just going to say that even Zen masters are human beings, and they can be subject to pressure by the government, I suppose, blackmail, Western clergy, you know, the Catholic Church, and all the excesses of power. There must be some similarities, but it was interesting to see how who was it that he was quoting? It was so it was so ingrained in the religion, in the philosophy itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing.
And I'm sorry, I realized I wasn't summarizing for the mic, so just to summarize briefly, basically, we're all human, and even if maybe there's realization, we're still human and we can still be clouded, you know. Yes?
I'm curious to know if Roshi ever commented publicly on his earlier statements at all, or, you know, obviously he said
repudiated.
But
yeah.
Well, that's a
good question. I don't know, because all of this came out much later. He had been dead for 25 years or something before Brian Victoria published his book. The question was whether Yasutani Roshi in any way publicly commented on his previous writings, and I don't know. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how much of the collective consciousness and evolution had to do with the thinking then versus
right. The
Buddhist thinking today.
Right.
Do you think that was just a product of the time, and militaristic thinking was more culturally acceptable?
So the question is, was it possibly just a product of the time and military militaristic views more culturally acceptable? I would say definitely it's a product of the time and place. I'll after the break I'll go through some other examples that are more contemporary. That when things get really intense and really conflictual, it's extremely easy to get more and more attached to your point of view. The stakes are much higher, so we really have to understand the cultural context.
But I would say, wouldn't you say that we're more awake today? That we have less of that today?
Are we more awake today? I don't know. Anyone want to come? Anyone else want to take a stab? Because of the evolution of consciousness.
Yeah.
I would say we're sort of more awake and more asleep. I'll just this will be my personal answer, and let me just see what you all think too. The way I think we're asleep more is that our lives are so busy and speedy and complicated, and it's always and TVs in the gas pumps now, and you know, it's like I think we're getting airports full of TVs. Like, you know, when do we ever just get a chance to stop and slow down and be aware? So, and I do think there is also a real evolution of consciousness happening too. I think it's sort of both. So I don't know how to answer that exactly, but and we're still doing lots of war. I mean, we are doing war. Our tax money is doing war right now. So, you know, anyone else want to?
Well, I personally I'm Jewish, so maybe that's, you know, coming into it. But I'm having a very difficult time. To me, it doesn't feel all that different now than separating religion and state and, you know, war and peace and all of those things. And to me, it seems, well, let's just take the easy way out and we'll all do what they say. And I'm having a big problem with that, because so what? He was all for war and killing, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, just kidding.
Right.
He
wasn't kidding.
Yeah.
And the whole Zen tradition wasn't kidding. I mean, this is real delusion. Yeah. But, you know, if Buddhism had taken root in the U.S. in World War II, it'd be really interesting to know. I mean, that's just completely pie in the sky to consider that. But, you know, what were, I think we all have a sense of what our religious traditions, you know, would be saying about militarism during World War II, but what would our spiritual traditions, our, you know, really deep spiritual traditions be saying about it?
Uh-huh. I'm really appreciative of the fact that you're bringing this up and the way you're framing it. I think it's incredibly insightful and responsible. I think that there couldn't be a more important conversation than, because everyone, we all operate from our cultural beliefs and our beliefs in general, and you know, it's very easy to, I mean, on any side of any conflict, personal, professional, nationalistic, there are individuals who are clouded by their own beliefs, and the extent to which we're all able to look at our own part in that, you know, if everybody does that work, then things will change dramatically. But it's difficult work to do, because
yes.
We don't want to look at ourselves, and we think we're right.
Yes.
We always think we're right. So I think it's there's nothing more important than questioning that and
So the comment is that this is so important to be looking at ourselves and our own contribution to, now these aren't your words exactly, but, you know, to just all of our mess, the big mess we're all in together. And it's hard, and it is hard. It is very hard the practice that we do, I mean, forget about strife and conflict, just sitting down, you know, with the intention to be present and aware of your experience, and then this comes and that comes and this recrimination and that one. It's hard. It is hard to sit down and do this. We are all warriors, you know, ordinary warriors. This is a profound practice, and it is incredibly essential that we all do this. Right.
So many things that aren't. But
right.
The spiritual practice and our dedication to the practice is the one thing that each and every one of us can truly love.
comment is, this is one thing we can control. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. I know I'm not a religious person, and I haven't been for quite a long time, since a child, basically. And one of the criticisms I've heard of, you know, I guess my philosophy is always identify your values and live by your values. And I've heard from the religious perspective, well, sure, that works well until the going gets tough, i.e. war, in which case religion could keep you firmly, you know, firmly attached to your values, whereas your own personal interpretation of them will vary. And yet here it's just the opposite to some extent. If somebody was individually following their spiritual path, they may very well have disagreed with this guy that you're quoting. Whereas the religion, the cultural religion of Zen, was endorsing an idea and probably encouraging it. So and deviating so much more from its roots that it just seems to flip it on its head, the notion that religion is a steadfast dedication to values that don't change, and that if you do it individually, you're going to be wishy-washy about it. It's kind of suggesting just the opposite.
Mm-hmm. So instead of religion being the steadfast thing that ties you to your values, it can be the very thing that gets in the way of your values or blinds you. So I'm just going to read another example, more on this militarism, nationalism, that's contemporary, and then we'll move on to sexism. Bummer. In Sri Lanka last September, this is an article from Foreign Affairs that came out this year. In Sri Lanka last September, a Sinhalese mob led by some 100 Buddhist monks demolished a Muslim shrine in the ancient city of Anuradhapura. A mob led by monks, Buddhist monks. As the crowd waved Buddhist colors, gold and red, a monk set a green Muslim flag on fire. The monks claimed that the shrine was on land that had been given to the Sinhalese 2,000 years ago, an allusion to their proprietary right over the entire island nation, as inscribed in ancient religious texts. Such chauvinism is at odds with Western preconceptions of Buddhism, but is in keeping with Sri Lanka's religious history. Militant Buddhism there has its roots in an ancient narrative called the Mahavamsa, which was composed by monks in the 6th century. The 6th century is 1,000 years after the Buddha's time. According to the Mahavamsa, the Buddha foresaw the demise of Buddhism in India, but saw a bright future for it in Sri Lanka. The Sinhalese take this as a sign that they are the Buddha's chosen people, commanded to preserve and protect Buddhism in its most pristine form. According to the myth, a young Sinhalese prince in the 2nd century BC armed himself with a spear tipped with a relic of the Buddha and led a column of 500 monks to vanquish Tamil invaders. Tamil are Hindu, not Muslim. In addition to defending his kingdom from mortal peril, the prince's victory legitimized religious violence as a means for national survival. Militant Buddhism was a driving force behind the 25-year war between the majority Sinhalese, 74% of the population, and the minority Tamils, 18%, who were fighting for an independent state in the island's north and east. During the war, monks repeatedly undercut efforts to work out a peace agreement. The clergy in the later years of the war became more overtly politicized. In 2004, the hardline National Heritage Party, known as the JHU, elected 7 of its members to parliament. All were monks, and the party ran on a platform calling for a return to Buddhist morality in public life. Soon after being seated, the JHU staged an intramural brawl on the floor of parliament. The article goes on that basically there was this element of Sri Lankan monasticism really spurring on the civil war, and a horrible, horrible civil war that just went on and on and on. Aitu Ralaye Ratatna, whom the Sri Lankan media dubbed the war monk, argued about the Tamils, "If they give up their weapons, then we can talk," he said. "If not, then we will control them by whatever means necessary. We should fight now and talk later. That's a Buddhist monk. 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
My question is, when you're talking about the monks, I mean, isn't it really, we're talking about the leadership, the spiritual leadership, or the governing, the bureaucratic leadership of the, so is it, isn't it really just, you know, the person's at the top?
The question is, aren't we just talking about leadership in people doing this?
I mean, you're more familiar with the bureaucracy of a monastery.
Yes.
So is it the person at the top who basically dictates what is right to...
The question is about leadership. So basically, wouldn't whoever's in charge of like all of Sri Lankan Buddhism say yes or no? No. I mean, there is leadership, and it's a council, you know, of leaders, and in each country, but that's very loose, you know. They might set sort of general policies. I don't know in this case of Sri Lanka whether that leadership was engaged or not. But if any monks are doing this. If any monks are saying, you know, we should fight now and ask questions later, talk later, that's notable. As the bloodshed wore on in the civil war, much of the Buddhist clergy gave its blessing to a final offensive on the separatist Tamil Tigers. In May of 2009, the Sri Lankan military emerged from that battle triumphant. But its brutal offensive against the Tigers has made President Mahinda Rajapaksa's government the target of broad international condemnation. Reliable estimates of civilian deaths range as high as 40,000 people in that, like, final offensive. Now, I don't want to it's easy for us to sit here and judge this. We're not there. We don't know what it's like to be in a civil war for 30 years. And I've talked to my brother-in-law, Sri Lankan. I know people who've lived in Sri Lanka as nonviolent peace workers. They do verify that, yes, there's this very militant streak within monasticism. This isn't just, you know, an aberration. This is actually a real thing. We also don't know what it's like to live in a country where there's been civil war for 25 years. And I've talked to very, very westernized, very liberal Sri Lankans who were very much in favor of this offensive because it did end the war. And it's like, I'm sorry, but it was worth it. And you can't really judge it because you don't know what it's like to be seeing, you know, people being killed all over the place year after year after year after year. So, but let's pop the bubble that, you know, Buddhism is always some kind of pure, just peace, love, and ochre robe religion. It's not. We can be deluded with our practice or our lack of practice. So a couple of key points. Notice this isn't based, when they're going back to the Mahavamsa, that's not based on what the Buddha taught. That's a monk's interpretation of their culture and history 1,000 years later. That's a key point. Another key point, how is it that the Dalai Lama, Mahagosananda, Thich Nhat Hanh, can come out of the same tradition as war monks? I'm just going to give my personal answer. The difference, I believe, is spiritual practice. And I don't know the situation exactly in Sri Lanka, but my sense would be I would be very surprised if there were monks who were really living by the Vinaya advocating this way. I don't know, but they couldn't. You know, they can't justify killing because of the first precept. But spiritual practice undercuts separation, us and them. It undercuts attachment to view. It makes you look at your own dirty laundry and helps you realize that you can actually be free even in the midst of your dirty laundry. And you don't have to wreak violence on the world in order to make the world a better place for you. So the Dalai Lama practices 4 hours a day. You know Thich Nhat Hanh got to practice still. I think any religion is capable of going to dogma if there's not genuine spiritual practice, you know, really as a big part of the tradition. And the Christian tradition has all kinds of contemplative practices. Those have been marginalized the entire tradition. So again, this is just my belief based on my practice that, you know, the Crusades, this and that, religious fundamentalism is pretty much like the opposite of spiritual practice. And all religions, it doesn't matter what, have this potential if there isn't really deep practice happening.
Peter, are you talking about primarily then meditation?
Yes.
Okay.
But not just meditation. That's our Buddhist way. But anything that helps us go towards the mystical, which is ultimately, as we've talked about, non-duality, freedom. So I'm looking at the time. I'm going to push us along to get to sexism. There's a big issue in the Theravada world right now around whether or not it is doctrinally okay for nuns to be fully ordained. Right now, in the Theravada world, let me say, up until the mid-90s, there have not been fully ordained Theravada nuns. There's nuns just on 10 precepts and who are inferior in status to men. It's built into the tradition. The historical context, as I said, with Buddhism is that the Buddha was doing something so radical with abolishing the caste system. He was also doing something radical by allowing women to join the Sangha. The cultural place for women, and I don't know a lot about this, so bear with me. But from what I've read, the cultural conditions for women back then were really not so good, and women were basically supposed to, you know, be the center of the family and be moms, and if they were unwed or barren or something, then they would be attached to either their parents' families or a sibling's family, and that was a woman's place, was basically to help raise kids. And so that the Buddha didn't allow women into the Sangha at first, meaning to ordain. And his stepmom had to petition him. And traditionally, she had to ask three times. And if someone asked the Buddha something three times, the Buddha has to say yes. So he said no to his mom twice. Women cannot ordain. She wanted to be ordained. She asked a third time, and he allowed it. And so she became the first nun. And there's been, you know, a tradition of nuns, you know, just as ancient pretty much as monks. But that tradition, somehow the transmission and the way the transmission occurs in monasticism is that elder monastics ordain younger monastics. And somehow the line of fully ordained nuns died somehow. And so with women's lib in the 60s and 70s coming around, there's been this movement to say we need fully ordained nuns in the Theravada world. There aren't any. This is not okay. And there's been all this doctrinal resistance to it. And the tradition that I'm steeped in through the Thai forest world is completely split right now around this issue, because half the camp can find no doctrinal support, and half says the not finding doctrinal support is just interpretation. If you actually, you can't find evidence for or against a way to start ordaining women now. I mean, I can go into the details just a little bit. The side that says we can't do this, as bad as it is that we can't ordain women, we just can't, because they need, women need to be ordained both by male monks and female nuns. Redundant, but there needs to be both genders represented in the ordination ceremony. So it can't happen. There's no fully ordained nuns now. And now, the other side of it, doctrinally, is that Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of the main translators, you know, very, very brilliant scholars, pretty much translated just about every word of the Buddha. So when you pick up the Majjhima Nikaya, it's translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he's a very progressive, you know, brilliant scholar. And he says that's just interpretation. You can't find in the Vinaya, which are the rules, where it actually says that. That's just been kind of a traditional or cultural hand-me-down. That his point of view is, what would the Buddha want if the Buddha were here right now? He would want us to follow the spirit of the Dharma, and he would want us to... I'm trying to remember Bhikkhu Bodhi's second point. He would also get that there's cultural change, and we have to be responsible to cultural change. So this is a very, very revered Pali scholar saying this. But the traditional clergy in Asian countries does not support this. But this is changing anyway. So in 1998 in Sri Lanka, there was a group of monks and actually non-Theravada nuns who conferred ordination and, in their view, have started a women's monastic lineage, full monasticism. And there's all kinds of controversy within the monastic world. And so that's the sexism I wanted to talk about, which is Bhikkhu Bodhi, very renowned scholar, saying you can't really find textual justification one way or the other for ordaining women. But the Buddha would want us to honor the spirit of Dharma and be a tradition that is not blatantly sexist. So the debate rages, though. It's still, if you go... I mean, I haven't been to Thailand. Maybe someone knows differently, but I haven't been there since 2004, but this wasn't even close to being an issue. I think it's only Westerners who've started doing this, mostly Westerners, but I'm pretty sure there's absolutely no recognition of this in the kind of, like, traditional hierarchy in Asian countries. Anyone know different? So... how you doing? Reactions, thoughts, comments, pain.
A question about what's the argument from the side who doesn't think that women should be ordained?
The argument is you have to have both male and female monastics present.
Is that true for male monks as well?
Nope. Just for women. And the other thing is that the second piece is that what happened in Sri Lanka is there were both men and women present, but the nuns were from a Chinese Mahayana lineage. And the doctrinaire monks say that's not okay. That's not a Theravada ordination. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, true, it wasn't Theravada, but it was... pre-Mahayana Buddhism, they follow the same vinaya, the same set of rules. They weren't being ordained to become Mahayana nuns. They were ordained to follow the same vinaya, that the Theravada follows. And in his view, that's enough to make it valid. So, and let me be clear, there are very, very advanced, realized monks who are taking the no women ordination school. And it's like, you're kidding me. I'm really surprised. It isn't just people who are new to the practice being doctrinaire. It's really some very, very experienced senior monks taking this view. And there's a big schism. And some people are just saying, we're doing it anyway. And it's happening. So that's the good news.
Isn't part of the Buddhist thought that life is change and that you have to accept the changes, sort of the ebb and flow of life? So I don't really get how they... I mean, I understand that traditionally you need someone ordained. But the fact that life is changing, I mean... Don't they look at it that we have to change with life? Or?
So the question is, can't they just look at it as things have changed and we need to change? I think, let me just say a little bit about the context of monasticism. There's a very, very ancient lifestyle that monks and nuns are living. This is compared to Zen or Tibetan. Again, as far as scholars can figure out, and this is kind of, we could say, the confidence in as well, maybe the conceit of the Theravada tradition, is we're doing it the way the Buddha taught it, like what you find in the Pali Canon. And Tibetans and Zens, we'll get into all kinds of argument about that, but that's the kind of Theravada view. We're the original Buddhism. We're still practicing what the Buddha taught. So there is a profound and deep reverence for, and let's say, attachment to this old way of life, because it works. It works. It really does. You know, there's a lot of good reasons to want to keep it conservative, because monasticism is very corrupt in Asia. So, you know, city monks can, you know, will handle money. They're not following the Vinaya. You know, it's a way to get out of working. I mean, and I don't want to characterize all of it that way, but it's there. And so this is inherently a very conservative, on purpose, tradition. So it's hard when you see how skillful and helpful that is, to then take this one piece and say, but not here. We'll allow it all over here, but we're not going to... It's sort of people saying, actually, we need to be steadfast because it's skillful, which might not be the same thing as being attached, you know? Maybe some of the very, like, advanced in their practice... monks are more like, who cares? I'm not opposed to women, but it completely undercuts the legitimacy of our conservative tradition to make an exception. I mean, I don't really know. But I think as Westerners, it's very easy lay people to not understand the full monastic context. But I think we all have our obvious opinions about this. So just two, and then we are going to end with a tiny bit of practice, because that's really the point. Yes.
Peter, I'm wondering if you could say more about why you consider this to be an example of sexism. And I'm saying that in part because when you've described it in response to, I think, Jane's question, your explanation for the rationale is simply, oh, this is just how we do it.
Right.
And that's a... It's a very sort of legalistic kind of argument rather
yes.
than one that's obviously
right.
gendered in some
right.
way.
So that's a good question. Thank you.
Why you call it sexism?
The question is, why would I call this sexism that actually this seems like merely a legalistic kind of interpretation? So where's the obvious gender bias? I'm really going by what Bhikkhu Bodhi says, which is it's only interpretation, this view that the proper ordination is not possible anymore. Once the lineage of fully ordained nuns died out, it's no longer possible to have a valid ordination. Bhikkhu Bodhi says that's not textually justifiable, like from the original Vinaya. It's only from later cultural understandings. So it's legalistic, but it's a biased kind of legalism. It's actually, so that's one piece, but the bigger piece, the sexism, is simply in the effect. Even if the intent isn't sexist, the effect is sexist, in that women cannot fully ordain, period. So, and again, I'm just deferring to someone who's a real scholar, one of the most revered scholars in the tradition. I'm not a scholar, so I'm taking his word for it. That's my limited opinion. But to me, if he's saying it's interpretation, it's we can do this, I'm going with that. If it's just 50-50, I'm going to go with it. But, you know.
Are you aware of whether there are other arguments that are made that are more, that make the justification about women not being able to be as aware or enlightened as men, or
No, it's not. It's never about
just about tradition.
The technical. I'm not aware of any of that kind of blatant sexism, like women can't get liberated or something. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I said two more because we're going to meditate. Were you the second one? I'm sorry. Yeah.
I just kind of piggybacking on that. I think my interpretation was that because it had existed initially, women were able to
yes.
fully ordain.
Yes.
That it's the bias comes in the selective interpretation of at what point in time. So I mean, it's clearly a bias when you're just picking a date and saying at this point in time we don't allow it. Whereas,
in Asia, I never saw blatant sexism when I was in the monastery, and I was in a monastery of Westerners. I never saw people saying, women are less than, women are this or that. It was always like, it's just not possible. Isn't it a shame? But it's not possible. So so the sexism might be in elevating a kind of legalistic approach that is commentarial and not original. It's not in the original Vinaya. It comes in the later commentaries, traditional views, cultural views.